Welcome to the My Stories podcast, hosted by Michigan Humanities. This podcast shares diverse stories from around Michigan, exploring our uniquely Michigander culture. Now, please enjoy this episode.
Hello and welcome back to Michigan Humanities Podcast, My Stories. Today we are revisiting a conversation that was part of our Why It Matters series between Dr. Jason Dibble and Dr. Donegal G. Young. Dr. Jason Dibble's teaching centers on interpersonal communication and relational communication, as well as quantitative research methods. He researches many things such as why people don't like to share bad news, the role of technology, and how people seek and maintain prospective romantic partners, persuasion, and the relationship people form with media characters. Dr. Donegal G. Young is a professor of communication and political science at the University of Delaware. Her research on the psychology and influence of non-traditional political information has been widely published. Her book, Irony and Outrage, examines satire and outrage as the logical extensions of the respective psychological profiles of liberals and conservatives. Dr. Young is a TED speaker and a committed public scholar. She has appeared on CNN, MSNBC, and the major broadcast networks, and her work and writing has appeared in dozens of newspaper and magazine articles, including op-eds in The Washington Post, Vox, and The Atlantic.
Thank you.
Yeah, I'm excited too. I think that there's a lot of great topics that we're going to go through, and I like the idea that we're going to do it in this sort of informal conversational style. I think that that's more accessible, and I think folks will appreciate that.
And full disclosure, this is the kind of stuff that we would do normally at a conference. If we were sitting down, we would catch each other for coffee or a beer or something like that, or a glass of wine, and then we would sit and pick each other's brain about this kind of stuff. So I really love this format too. People can listen in, and we'll try and share some ideas and see what we can come up with here. Also, full disclosure, I read your book over last fall. This is what it looks like, everybody. You should get it. I figured I'd take the opportunity to plug it for you.
Thank you.
Yeah, by all means. And when I read it, and at that time, Jen had already asked me about this Why It Matters series. And as I was reading the book, I'm going, we got to get Dr. Young on the show. So thank you for being here. And I'm super, super excited. So the two of us came up with these sort of three topic areas that we're going to cover today to sort of structure our conversation. And it's all gearing toward the impact of social media on our polarized political environment. And then really importantly, what are some ways we can move forward to promote healing? So we're really hoping to leave with some takeaways here. So the three kind of topics that we set up with is we'll spend a little bit of time first talking about how did we get here? How did we become so polarized? And then we'll spend a little bit of time talking about the role of the media and social media in pushing that polarization. And then we'll finish up with talking about some takeaways and how we can go forward. If that sounds okay.
Perfect.
And I will try to keep us on time. But you know, conversation is fun and it's messy, and that's what makes it fun. So why don't you go ahead and set the stage for us, Dr. Young, and let us know, what are some of your thoughts as far as how we got here? I mean, everybody, it's pretty obvious. We can see that we're all polarized. We hear about that in the media. Everybody's treating each other as the other, the enemy, mm-hmm. and so on. What are some of the long-term slow burning effects that got us here? And then maybe we can talk a little bit later about some of the quicker acting things, but this stuff doesn't happen in a vacuum.
Right. So I think folks are surprised when they learn that the American Political Science Association back about 60 or 70 years ago actually came out with an essay basically saying that they thought that the two political parties, Democrats and Republicans, were not ideologically distinct enough and that they were not different enough. And so what the party should be doing is become more responsible by becoming more ideological and ideologically distinct, meaning they should stand for very different things in terms of the role of government in people's lives. And to even think that seems so bonkers right now, because we're like, wait, what? Well, yeah, because after World War II, it was a unique moment in American history, right? You have high trust in government, high trust in media. You have very low political polarization. And this tends to happen in the wake of some kind of a national tragedy or a war, right? The rally around the flag effect, brings folks together across parties. So you had things, it was a really peachy moment in American history in many ways. But political scientists said the trouble with that is when folks go to the polls, they don't really know what the parties stand for in terms of issue positions and policies. So wouldn't it be better to have them ideologically distinct? Mm. As I always say, be careful what you wish for, because over the next 30 years, based largely on issues related to race, policies surrounding race, and aspects of states' rights, especially in the South, there was a realignment of the parties such that it was the Democratic Party that became more associated with liberalism, and the Republican Party became associated with more conservatism and states' rights. And if you move forward to, if you actually look at the trends on political polarization, it's clear that like really this stuff has taken off in the last like 30 years. Like that, I mean, even over the last 10 years, you're like, wow, it's gotten worse over the last 10 years. And just to be clear, when we're talking about polarization, we're talking about two things. One is the sort of issue extremity of people within each party. So increasingly Democrats hold more consistently liberal views on issues, and Republicans are holding more consistently conservative views on issues, as opposed to having people who kind of are, you know, conservative Democrats or liberal Republicans, which we don't really see so much anymore. The other part, the part that's really dangerous, is this affective polarization. Mm. You know, affect is a fancy word for emotion. And affective polarization just means we hate the other side more and more. And, you know, when you look at the, in 1994, folks might remember the Republican Revolution in Congress and Newt Gingrich and the Contract for America. And when the Republican Party said, we are going to run people for office who are going to promise and swear on the Capitol steps that they are going to work to pass legislation that is conservative in orientation, small government, lower taxes, smaller government. That sort of put a flag in the sand. And Democrats, of course, replied in kind. And that kind of issue polarization also then fueled this identity polarization where we increasingly dislike the other side.
Where you were talking before we started the webinar, you were mentioning a little bit too, kind of two different layers of polarization, you know, sort of the political elites versus kind of the common people's polarization that we're seeing right here. Does that relate to what you were just saying there?
Absolutely. So interestingly, the idea of issue polarization, that's what we're really seeing in Congress. We're seeing that Democrats are not compromising or negotiating with Republicans and vice versa. So you don't see a lot of this bipartisan sort of movement or legislation being passed as much as you did like in the 70s and the 80s, right? Footnote that, by the way, because the 1980s, there was an interesting, Ronald Reagan was able to be quite successful. And there are reasons why that is true in terms of having spearheading legislation that got passed. So the other thing that I'll just say with regards to the divide between elites and regular citizens is that among elites, we see issue polarization. Among regular citizens, what we see more of is affective polarization. You know, most people actually do not have super cohesive belief systems. You know, a lot of people don't have an overarching ideology and they're not even sure what that is. So the vast majority of folks are in the middle and they might have a mix of things. The issue is party has become a sort of symbol. Party has become a cue for an identity. And that identity goes to the core of who we are. And we have an ego-driven connection to that identity. And then that becomes our team. And then opposite teams, then we don't like the other team. So that's where there's a distinction.
Mm. I love that you pointed out the emotional aspect too. I was just reading another book and actually I've been doing a lot of reading about emotions. It's been totally turning upside down everything I've learned about emotions. We were always taught that there are six universal emotions that everybody knows. Well, that turns out to be wrong. That turns out to be false. And one of the things that I was realizing is that emotions, like you said, this emotional issue, polarization, there's a lot that's going on behind the scenes that is driving us that we not, may not be aware of. And one of the things that's pertaining to emotions was that the claim that this book was making is that emotions will do our thinking for us.
Yeah.
And so the idea is if it's, especially if it's something like negative, like a fear or disgust, when somebody makes you afraid, you don't ponder the poisonous spider. You just go, ew, and run away. Right. You know, if something makes you disgusted, you don't ponder that puddle of brown goo in the road. You just sidestep and be on your way. We only kind of ponder the pleasant things. So it makes it really easy for a potential bad actor who may not have the best interest at heart, who just wants to persuade us to harness our tendency to follow those emotions. And so if they instill fear in us, they know that one, that'll motivate us to act. And two, it'll prevent us from thinking deeply about whether they're getting us to do the right thing or not.
Yeah. I mean, it really is that negative emotions are sort of the special sauce of mobilization and persuasion. Emotions are very, very efficient at getting people to do things, unfortunately, because they can be exploited, as you said. And I want to come back a little bit and bridge these two conversations, because there is a book that is at the center of everything I'm doing and thinking about now. And that's the book by Liliana Mason, Uncivil Agreement. And she's a political scientist who tracked the makeup, the demographic, socio-demographic makeup of the two political parties over many decades, and has found that the Democratic and Republican Party have become internally more homogenous, so more internally the same, on dimensions of race and religion and geography and all these other things, meaning the Republican Party over time has become more white, Christian, rural, right? Like all of these things that are really core dimensions of our identity. The Democratic Party has become more diverse, secular, urban. So now you have something that political scientists have identified is very problematic for democracies that have multiple parties, right? Which democracies need. When the political parties actually map onto more primal identifications, more primal identities, race, right? Religion. Like what is more primal than your race or ethnic makeup, or your religion and where you live and your culture and what, how you think of as sort of the fabric of your life. Now, the Republican and Democratic parties are so distinct on these sort of primal dimensions of humanity. And that is where we have a problem, because that's where what's called social identity theory comes into play, right? So I have a lot of different identities. I am a mom and I'm a professor and I live in this neighborhood and I drive the CRV and whatever.
I'm left-handed.
But I also imagine now our political identity now is a meta identity that encompasses our religion and our race and our ethnicity and where we live and our culture and the music we listen to and the food that we eat and the car that we drive. Okay, well, now we have a problem, because that identity can be used and the other party's identity can be used to other in primal ways that can fuel those negative emotions, especially fear, hate, and disgust. And once those emotions are at play, you're exactly right. It short circuits our ability to think very rationally and thoroughly about evidence and issues and arguments.
That really surprised me, that when I read that part, because I mean, we've heard in the culture, you know, oh, that's just shameless fear mongering, and people hear that idea, but I don't think they really think about the mechanisms by which that might work, and how it's not just a buzz phrase that we say fear mongering. It does happen, and here's why it's so effective.
Yeah. And I think that maybe that's a good segue to talk about, to start getting into that second piece, right, about media.
Yeah, let's go there. So because, we're going to talk about, go ahead.
Yeah, social media. And so I think about the media ecosystem. They're all the same problems, but they're just different scopes. So the cable news media ecosystem, we know that the way that cable news, the economics of cable news, and cable programming in general, right? We, the audience, we are the product that is bought and sold, right? The product is not the content, right? Because no, that's not happening. We are being bought and sold. And once we are being bought and sold, that changes the whole contract that we're in. If we're being bought and sold, then the calculus is what's going to make us watch? What's going to make us stay? What's going to make us come back? And you can imagine negative emotions have a real role to play there. Now, the social media situation is even more obvious in terms of the fact that we are the product being bought and sold, like Facebook especially. So Facebook has these techniques where they can micro-target advertisements to us based on things that we've literally like shared with friends and family or different groups that we've liked or the movie page that we said we're a fan of or whatever. And once you're at that level of micro-targeting, think about how the internal logic of Facebook works. Our data, our behavior fuels the machinery of Facebook, right? So I see
the algorithms, they're everywhere.
They're everywhere. I see a story that makes me mad about politics or about COVID, and I click the angry face and then I share it. Now, the algorithm is then going to reward that story because it generated attention. And what the algorithm wants is things that generate attention. So those come to the top of my newsfeed, things that are like it, right? So the artificial intelligence will, and the machine learning, whatever, will determine, oh, this is kind of like that thing that made Dana mad the other day. Here's another one of those. So that is, that mechanism is just feeding that beast, right? So emotions are then, my gosh, they're rewarded.
Yeah. In your book, you wrote about some other media too, you know, what we call the legacy media and kind of our line of work, where you talked about, you made some really interesting connections that I think are worth talking about when it comes to how liberal mindsets prefer a certain format of programming versus conservative mindsets. And so, and that's kind of developed into what we see as like the talk radio versus kind of the satire, John Stewart kind of programming. Yeah. Do you want to start there and talk a little bit about that? And then if we can we hook that to the social media stuff?
Absolutely. Yeah. Cause the mechanisms are related. So, it's kind of a hard pill for folks to swallow if they haven't heard the political psychology literature before, but, really the political psychology literature frames political ideology, right? Being liberal or conservative, as sort of an outcome or manifestation of other primal ways in which we relate to the world around us. And the thing that's at the heart of all of this is the concept of threat. There are some folks who are very concerned about, and they're high monitors of interpersonal threat. And if you're like that, you are going to then prioritize efficiency and survival, which makes sense because you're looking around the corner, checking that your doors are locked, right? You make decisions quickly and efficiently. And there are certain psychological traits that are that accompany that. So on the other side, for folks who aren't worried about threat.
And those are adaptive, by the way.
Yes, they're very functional. Yeah, yeah, yeah. They're wonderful.
Just make sure those are adaptive.
Yeah. So, and here's the thing. You know, you can come at this and think that the traits of one side are actually better or worse than the other. But where I came with the book is that we are so screwed if the other side disappears because we cannot survive without them. Whatever side you're on, we need the other side. The problem is the exploitability of these things. So let me just say, so for liberals are the ones who tend to be less worried about interpersonal threat. So that's kind of a luxurious place to be in terms of like, if you're not worried about survival, you can think about things for longer and chew your cud and, you know, maybe revise your judgments in light of new information. Conservatives make decisions really quickly, consistently, and confidently, right? Whereas, you know, the kind of stereotypes, the hemming and hawing, no, let me write a pro-con list, I still can't decide. But these two ways of approaching the world also, believe it or not, correlate with preferences for different kinds of art, music, and aesthetics. So the stereotypes actually fit. So the idea of like liberal jazz, you know, jazz is, it's hard to make sense of. It's, you can't really anticipate where it's going. That's something that liberals tend to appreciate more than conservatives. Mm. Abstract art, same thing. Conservatives prefer realistic art. And stories that wrap up at the end. Conservatives really like those. You know, the science fiction stories where you're not sure, was it all a dream or not? Conservatives have psychological traits that make them sort of more annoyed by that kind of a plot line. All of this is to say that content that is clear, efficient, threat-oriented, tells you what to be worried about, tells you what to do about it, should appeal to folks who are, and these, this is for social and cultural conservatism. That's important. Mm-hmm. This is about conservatism on issues of like race and gender and sexuality and crime.
Those, we're not necessarily talking about D's or R's here. We're talking about,
Yeah. And so when you think about it, you know, political opinion talk shows are really, really the bread and butter of social and cultural conservatives because they scratch the itch. Whereas liberals who kind of like to unpack things and solve riddles and they don't like to be told things directly because they want to feel like they're coming up with it on their own, even if they're not, they tend to gravitate towards content that is more open-ended, that is more ambiguous, which helps to explain why ironic satire is the sort of like genre of liberalism. Mm. You look at the ratings and the profits of political talk radio from conservatives versus liberals. Liberals cannot do opinion talk.
Okay. No, right.
And MSNBC, I dare say, is never going to make as much money as Fox News. They just they don't do it as well. And the audiences don't love it as much. But conservatives have tried to make satire and gosh darn it, it has failed. Mm. And liberals really dominate in that genre. So this is an explanatory mechanism that I have come up with. And, you know, there might be other ones, but this is where I've landed. And the reason that this matters is because what we're talking about now, once again, is a bifurcation of culture. We're talking about people going into these unique spheres and being told or being provided a view of the world that matches their worldview. And they're being provided that worldview in their preferred aesthetic that makes them happy and comfortable. Mm-hmm. So once again, it's this reinforcement effect. The place this is particularly problematic and where it's not symmetrical is the fact that that political talk genre is threat oriented. So the negative emotions that it's going to reignite frequently, right? Like the fear or the anger. Again, those are exploitable emotions. And that's where I see there's an asymmetric effect because those are emotions that mobilize, get people upset and say, you know, when you're angry, you want to act because there's a target to your anger, right? So that's where I see them as not quite the same.
And in, you know, in, back in our days of, you know, Cave Jason and Cave Dana, those acting on in the face of a threat would be adaptive.
I mean, exactly.
You got to run away from the saber-toothed tiger. So we're not saying there's anything wrong with acting on your fears.
No,
but like you
no,
said, it's being exploited.
Exactly. Because think about it. Who decides what the threats are? That's the tricky part. Who decides what the threats are? I think that we could all venture to guess that like, yeah, there are real threats out there. There really are. But to what extent are threats manufactured by media? And to what, who gets to decide? Who gets to be the arbiter of reality to say, actually, you know what? This really is actually a threat. So you are right to respond. Unfortunately, so much of our experience today is mediated. Mm-hmm. Puts a lot of power in the hands of the people who get to make those selections, right? The gatekeepers wield a lot of power.
And everything becomes a threat suddenly.
Yeah.
One of the things that drives me nuts about that too is even if it's not a threat, it's all become breaking news.
Right.
You see breaking news on the Chiron, no matter when you turn on your favorite cable channel, they always hit breaking news. I'm like, nothing, it's not all breaking news.
Yeah. I remember, that's funny you say that. I remember one time I turned on the TV and my son was there. He was young and he was like, wait, there's breaking news. I'm like, oh yeah, yeah. It's all, yeah, that's it, it's always breaking.
Yeah.
News channel.
And it makes you wonder, you know, at what point was there going to be a kind of a boy cried wolf effect where, you know, I always look at, like, remember car alarms when they first came out, you would pay attention to them. Now, if one goes off, you're like, I hope they're getting broken into. I hate that sound. Right.
You know, I actually, what you're talking about, though, I think that that is part of what has driven the lack of trust in media and the sense that their mainstream press is not to be trusted. When you look at trust in media over the last 70 years, it has plummeted. And not all of that came from Vietnam and you know, gosh, Watergate actually was the height of trust in media. But, you know, not all of that came, you know, just because of changes in the world. A lot of that came because the press was being squeezed for profit and chasing eyeballs, which transformed how they did their business. You know, it's very hard to isolate causality with these things, of course, but when you see the sort of cynical responses that folks have to media, because it is preposterous, right? Like some of the ridiculous things they do and the sensationalism, that opens the door for misinformation. Mm-hmm. Folks stop trusting the mainstream outlets. They still need to get information somewhere. So where are they going to get it? Mm. So there are people and bad actors who capitalize on that lack of trust. And they're like, oh, good. They're sick of those breaking news things. Oh, good. They hate media. They think that they're, you know, vultures. Journalists are like vultures. Let's capitalize on that. And let's sell them some baloney over here on this website.
To your point, I was just reading also that we actually trust Google search results more than we do the legacy news media.
Yeah.
So what, in which of course that's curated too.
Yeah.
Right. The algorithms.
What's wild about that?
So we trust the algorithms more than we do the human beings who give us our news.
And the thing that's really tricky about the Google searches is that if you hear something, maybe if you see something on Facebook or a friend says something, right? And you're like, that seems weird. That doesn't seem right. Right? Like if somebody says like a conspiracy theory, like, you know, the vaccines change your DNA, which they don't.
Right? No, they don't.
You hear that. So what do you put in Google? You put in Google, do vaccines change your DNA? And do you know what Google finds? A whole bunch of articles about how, because it is not sophisticated enough to try to do the debunking. You've asked it if this happens. So Google's like, oh, well, here's all the key search terms you just put in. And it's from baloney.net. Mm-hmm. Yes. Right. So, you know, when you find what you're looking for on Google, if you are looking to learn that the earth is flat, guess what you'll find? And then you find it and you're like, I knew it.
I call that the raw sewage. You just unleash the raw sewage at that point. And yeah, the legacy media have cried wolf so much that they've undercut their own credibility to the point where now we trust Google. And what's that? Just the gateway to the raw sewage. Well, that's good. Let's put the bow on that then and bring it back to social media. So what are some things we need to keep in mind when it comes to social media and exacerbating our polarization? And then we'll kind of morph into what should we start doing about it in order to cross these divides.
Yeah. So with social media, again, the economics of social media and the logics, they are designed to arouse you, not a positive arousal, but some kind of emotional response that gets your blood boiling. Mm. That is the engine that drives the algorithm. So if that is true, then you need to think about, when you see something in your newsfeed and it makes you feel angry or sad or fearful or disgusted, I always tell my students, you got to ask, who is trafficking in your emotions and what do they have to gain from that? So they probably have money to gain, right? If it is something that has been purchased, they might also have power to gain from that. So that's a really tricky thing. Mm-hmm. The other thing I'll say with regards to social media is that when you have what's called valence, right, which is a direction, an evaluation, positive or negative, the Facebook faces are that are used the most are positive and negative valence. Mm-hmm. That tells the algorithm what you like and what you hate. And it's going to give you more of what you like and give you less of what you hate, which means that you are, by definition, going to end up seeing belief-confirming content. What's important, though, is that the research on echo chambers, you know, an echo chamber is when you only hear your own beliefs and your own values parroted back to you. The research on echo chambers suggests that echo chambers do not exist on social media as much as we think. People are still exposed to other points of view, from especially from friends and family on Facebook. The danger is, there's two dangers. One is, if you block or mute people from your Facebook feed because you get annoyed at seeing their stuff, you know, it's tempting, but unless they're constantly sharing false information that you really feel is dysfunctional for you, my suggestion would be, do not block or mute. Okay. It's good to have that in there, especially if it's someone who you love, right? If it's someone who you love, you should keep their stuff in there unless it's all mis or disinformation. The other thing to be mindful of is what are called Facebook groups or Facebook pages. This is really tricky. And this was more of a problem a couple of years ago. Some entities would have a Facebook page that's like, it's a page about puppies. And so people would go and like the page. Well, guess what? Now that page has millions of people who like the page. Well, anyone can come in and purchase that puppy page from the puppy people, use it as an outlet. And all of a sudden, you will see stuff. Perhaps it's Russian propaganda.
Yeah.
Perhaps it's white nationalist propaganda. And you're like, well, I didn't sign up for that, but you signed up for the puppy page.
And now we have that talk with my students. The same kind of thing happens. They call it like farming. And then they sell off the page, and people don't realize that. The common trigger for that was, at least that was going around here, was you'll share this if you love Jesus. So click share if you love Jesus. So they're already tapping right into your Christian sensibilities or your spiritual sensibilities. So people are thinking, well, I can't turn my back on the Lord.
You know, right.
Thank goodness we have Facebook now. I can show Jesus how much I love him.
Right.
And so they click share, and they're just racking up those shares, whether it's puppies or Jesus. Then they sell off that page that's already popular. So it goes through to the top of the algorithms, and they just swap out the content for raw sewage.
That's right. That's exactly
boom.
Right. Yeah. I saw it on my son's Instagram too. When he was like 13, you know, there were Instagram pages that would follow him, and they were like funny memes and stuff. And so he'd follow back, you know, because that's what you do, follow back. And over time, though, those accounts would change their content, and it became really dreadful, especially because, you know, my son is a white 13-year-old male. So there were folks who were like, oh, come to the dark side, kiddo. But so, you know, being aware of those economics and those functions helps you make better choices. The final thing with Facebook, I'll say, is the idea of Facebook groups, which also can be tricky. So there are groups that start where you might have a friend who, maybe you have a friend who you do yoga with or you play golf with, and they're like, oh, I'm going to invite you to this group I'm a part of. It's like, for people who are interested in, I don't know, what's a perfect example? But people who are interested in like eating healthy foods. Great. Okay. Yeah. So you get
keto dieters.
Yeah. So you get in that group, and then guess what happens? People start talking not just about healthy foods, but they start talking about, okay, so holistic medicine, okay. Anti-Western medicine, okay. Then it turns into opposition to vaccines. Then it turns into vaccine conspiracy theories. Okay. So at what point are you cognizant enough to jump ship? Because it's a slow boil, right?
The boiling frog. You turn up the water on the frog. Yeah. Yeah.
So these are just things you need to be aware of. Yeah. Just things to be aware of your own social media experiences.
We could talk about this just by itself, but I want to give, we got a few minutes left before we throw it over to some Q&A. What I wanted to do is let's talk about some ways that we can actually have real conversations to get across that ground level polarization that we're dealing with. We're not talking about the political elites here. We're talking about communicating with our, our family members who have drunk one flavor of Kool-Aid or the other, and we want to get them back into the family. Yeah. What are some real things we can do?
Well, first of all, recognize that the people who are in your family and your friends who you love and who, especially if you feel like they've gone down a misinformation rabbit hole or if they're into conspiracy theories, that can seem like all hope is lost. And that can be very, very challenging. Mm-hmm. But rather than seeing that person as like an enemy, if you recognize that that person has become a pawn and the evildoer is not the person, right?
Right.
The person to be angry at is the media infrastructure, the political people who are exploiting this. It's not your cousin. It's not your neighbor. So thinking in those terms, I think, can be really helpful. The other thing is, remember how I said that the political identity has become a meta identity, mm-hmm. stands in for all kinds of other things. What that means is our job really should be to try to dilute our political identity.
Right.
To the extent possible, relating to people about things that are universal. Parenting. Right?
Yeah.
Traffic, sports,
yep.
things that are things
talk
that
about the weather.
Yes, talk about the weather.
Go ahead and talk about the weather.
You know, cooking and gardening. Oh my gosh. Now, even those spaces online, some of those groups have even become political, but to the extent possible, connecting on those shared experiences. Also recognizing that the people who are dislike you, who have the different psychological traits from you, the people who are concerned about threat or are not concerned about threat, their way of orienting to the world is such a gift, and it's a gift that you may not have.
That's right.
So recognizing that and thinking in those terms and having gratitude for what they bring to the table can reframe how you think of interacting with them.
Yeah. I don't know who it was. It was Fumbly Famous said that, you know, everybody knows something that you don't.
Yeah.
So chat with them and try and find out what you don't know that they do and you can learn from.
Right. And you know, if you do have folks in your life who you care about, who believe information that is demonstrably false, going at them and mocking them or saying, how can you possibly believe that? Recognize that part of where that comes from is from, you know, there are all kinds of things that correlate with conspiracy theory beliefs. And some of them are like, if you feel like you are socially left behind, if you feel like you're socially maligned, then you're going to be more likely to believe in conspiracy theories. And gosh darn it, if you mock them, all you're doing is fanning the flames.
Yeah.
You're fanning the flames. Like, how is that possibly going to help you? What you need to do is allow them to save face. Allow
exactly.
them to have their dignity, right? Which means, in a lot of ways, avoiding that stuff altogether and tapping into those other shared experiences, experiences that transcend these political camps.
I wrote a couple op-eds on the exact point, which is, you know, people are tempted to ridicule all those crazy nutbags or whatever it is. And you're right. That's only going to add, pours gas on the fire.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
when you push them back into that corner, you give them no place to resolve to save their face. And so the only way they can do it is by lashing out or acting out or continuing further down.
Or doubling
to find
down.
More people who are like them.
Yeah. And
so they stay in the hole.
I've seen some really, really wonderful examples actually on Twitter from folks who, like Sarah Silverman has done this a couple of times, the comedian Sarah Silverman, she'll get trolled awful, hateful things. Now, just to be clear, I don't think that it is the responsibility of folks to engage with stuff like this, but she,
right.
and she said, why are you so upset? Like, what is hurting you? Like, you seem like your anger. I don't understand where it's coming from. And basically like, you are my fellow human and I care about you and you seem at the end of your rope. And the person wrote back and it started this whole long thread. And it turned out that the person had either lost their job or was struggling for mental health issues. And so she used her network to like help reach out to his city services to see if she could get him some help. And it's like, it takes a lot of work, and that may, not every moment is the moment to engage in that kind of work. But if you have it in you, do the work.
And that's what people don't realize, is that listening does take work. And it's not just something, you know, most of the time we're not even listening. We're trying to think up, what am I going to say next? Instead of just sitting there going, tell me about your experiences.
Yeah.
And we always say, you know, that you're in the same camp as me, being a communication person, listen to understand, not to change their mind.
Right.
So give them a chance to say, what are you afraid of? What are you thinking? What does this do for you? What does this mean for you? And just let them talk about it. Yeah. And, you know, no matter what side you're on, we can learn something from each other. And you got to connect on a human level.
Yeah, I've also found that if there is someone who believes something that is demonstrably untrue, if you ask them, is there any information that I could give you that would convince you that you're wrong? Anything? Sometimes they'll say no.
Mm-hmm.
At which point it kind of frees you up, because you're like, okay. And it allows you to say, okay, so it feels like this isn't even about the argument we're having. It seems like this is just about your view of the world. And so I can't change that. So let's move on.
Yeah. No. And you don't have to change it. That's the thing. You know, even you can, maybe changing it comes later, if at all, but you can still find a way to relate to them as a human and reconnect with those relationships. You know, one of the things I've been using is, you know, if you see somebody saying something, I'll point out that, hey, you know, I know you to be a smart, you know, you raised me to be a smarter person than that, or, you know, you raised me to think differently, or you raised me to be critical about this kind of stuff. And sometimes that's enough to catch, you know, certain relatives or whatever to say, oh, wait a minute. Yeah. Okay. I see where you're coming from, you know?
Yeah.
You're my family and I love you, and work with that. Yeah. I see JJ coming in. Jen.
Hey.
Sorry, viewers. I call her that. It's an old college thing.
Jason and I go way back. So we do have a couple questions that have come up from participants in the chat as you guys have been talking. And so one of them was, what responsibility do you think social media platforms have for stopping the spread of false information? And do you think that kicking perpetrators off platforms contributes to further division?
Great question. Yeah. So this is a very, very tricky situation. In fact, the Facebook has an oversight board that's wrestling with some of these things. Their decision to ban Trump from the platform was a really challenging one, I think, because by definition, someone who is a democratically elected leader should be able to have a platform to communicate with folks. Their decision to block his account or suspend his account, my understanding that it was under the sort of rubric of imminent threat, that on the day of the insurrection and in the aftermath of that, that a case could be made that his rhetoric was going to further inflame violent actions. And so that's why they did that. That's why they did make that decision. What Zuckerberg has said, and I get very tongue-tied with this, but what Zuckerberg has said in the past is that because we do not understand intention, and you can never understand intention, you have no way of knowing if someone is putting out information that they know to be false, or if they actually believe that it's true. And if someone is wrong about stuff, do we want Facebook to be policing that? You know, do we want Facebook to be the arbiters of the truth? I don't think we do. And I'll tell you what, they don't want to be. We don't want them to be that. Imagine if Facebook got to decide what's real and what's not all the time. Disaster. Mm-hmm. Right? Especially think about what that would do in terms of like news stories related to media regulation and impact. Well, goodness, I wonder what Facebook is going to, how they're going to weigh in on what's real there. We don't want that. There has to be some kind of a mechanism. And I think it is, the problem is they've tried to do crowdsourcing as well, like put it out to users to decide what's true and what's false. Well, my gosh, guess what? motivated reasoning says we weigh in and say, oh, that agrees with me. That's true. Oh, that disagrees with me. That's false. So I don't know what the answer is, but I'll tell you that Facebook policing content in terms of accuracy or Twitter doing that is not what we want. Them perhaps bringing folks offline because they are engaging in hate speech or, you know, they're causing imminent violence. Yes, that we do want them to be. Mm-hmm.
So kind of piggybacking on that, we have a couple questions here about, you know, how do we present information to people that might be, you know, on extreme ends of the scale, either, you know, either way? You know, do we seek core agreements on basic issues? You know, how do we present that information? And then maybe, you know, kind of, you know, to put a bow on that, are there resources we can tell people about where they can read up more about techniques on how to do that, you know, in a, you know, sensitive and intentional way?
Well, if you're talking about, so I'm an interpersonal guy, so I'm always talking about, you know, face-to-face conversations with people. There is a new initiative that came out a few years ago called the Listen First Project. And I think, I don't know, do you know about that one, Dr. Young?
I don't. Oh.
So we have a mutual colleague in communication. His name is Dr. Graham Bode. And he didn't actually start the Listen First Project, but he's pretty high up the food chain over there. And their whole goal, it's a totally nonpartisan initiative. Yeah. And you can just go to Listen First Project, I think it's .com or .org, or Google it. And it's got all kinds of resources to help people have conversations across tough divides. And so they do talk about things like being curious and just listening and how much work it takes and so on. As far as social media goes, I don't know. I like the idea of, I've heard about George Lakoff's truth sandwiches. Do you hear about those?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. That's
so, go ahead.
Yeah, no, you know, Jay Rosen at NYU is always talking about the truth sandwich. And one of the problems in calling out information that is empirically false is that you will, you know, amplify it by even talking about it. So the way the brain works is that if we hear it, even if we've been told it's wrong, we still heard it and it's still in there. Mm-hmm. One of the ways that we can interrupt that is by giving the accurate information first, right? Then saying this false account came out that said this thing, and then ending with the accurate information again, right? So that's the truth sandwich, that the false
sandwich,
the meat of the sandwich. So that also can help. I also wanted to say, it sounds like the Listen First Initiative has some goals in common with the National Institute for Civil Discourse, which is out at the University of Arizona. And that was formed after the shooting where Congresswoman Gabby Giffords was shot. Mm. And it is a bipartisan effort to try to find ways to facilitate understanding and really thoughtful dialogue. And I am a member of their research network. And they do really awesome stuff. And they also have programs and materials and resources to help folks at the community level, because that's where this needs to happen, really, at the community level, engage with members of their towns and town councils through the spirit of civility and engagement and openness.
That's fantastic. So maybe just one more quick question before we wrap up things this evening. When we're talking about media literacy and we're talking about how we can spot things that, you know, maybe require us to do a little bit more research, when should we begin this media literacy conversation? Should it be, you know, what age? Is it middle school? Is it high school? Is it college?
Yeah, great question. So I am a little bit provocative on the media literacy front, and here is why. I think we got to be really careful when we talk about media literacy. We've got to be very strategic about it. Teaching folks about media economics and how media work and the fact that we're the product and why content looks the way it is, that can actually be done from the very young ages. When kids are watching advertisements, I think it's key for them to understand what those are for and why they're being done. No, this is not a public service announcement about the sugar cereal. This is, you know, because kids will tend to think like, oh, look at this great news. We have
it's another little show.
Yeah. So that can start at a very young age. But the reason that I'm a little critical of the media literacy stuff is because if we're always telling people to be critical consumers of information, our own biases are so deep that we feel like we're being critical consumers by saying that disagrees with me, so it must be wrong. Mm. That's not what we want, because what ends up happening then is that folks throw out everything. They're like, I can't trust any of this stuff. Well, just because something disagrees with you doesn't mean it's false. So instead, I think being strategic about teaching media economics, teaching strategies to fact check, Googling things. If you see something, Google it and see if it's been corroborated. Talk about what legacy journalistic institutions are and the resources that they bring to bear on their reporting. The New York Times and the Washington Post, and Wall Street Journal, these are organizations that have professional standards that have to be met in order to get to publication. And so I think the more that we think about those things and the more that people are aware of those things, instead of just being like, be a skeptical reader, be a critical consumer. I don't know about you, but I know that when I'm skeptical, it's about the stuff that disagrees with me.
Yeah. And when you say corroborating, that was the key there. A lot of people don't realize, I mean, we're talking to the Wikipedia generation where they just get answers on Wikipedia. But when you're trying to be media literate, you could Google something, but don't just take the top site that pops up and go, well, there it is, right? You got to look through several sites. So when you say corroborate, we mean check more than one. You know, if you see it in more, you know, you're seeing it at NPR and Wall Street Journal and Fox News and NBC, and all of them are kind of converging on the same idea, that's probably where the truth is. If you're seeing it on one of these fringe sites or where the raw sewage is, then you might not be seeing the truth. And that's the other piece to it. Yeah.
Great. Well, we should wrap things up tonight so that we are respectful of people's time. Thank you so much.
It goes too fast.
It does go so fast. And I know that we have some questions that we didn't quite get to tonight, but to let you know, all of these webinars are then followed up with what we kind of call an afterglow, which will then be turned into a podcast. So after this evening, Donegal, Jason, and I will get back together, and we're going to talk about some things that maybe bubbled up for them while these conversations were happening. We'll address some of the questions that we didn't quite get to this evening just for sake of time. And then those podcasts will be published on the Michigan Humanities website. So we invite you to come back and take another listen to these, and then also be able to listen to the afterglow afterwards. So again, thank you to everyone that joined us this evening. Thank you so much, Jason and Donegal, for joining us tonight. Thank you again. Take care, everyone. Stay safe. And we look forward to talking with you all again very soon.
Thanks so much.
Thank you for tuning in to the My Stories podcast. We hope you enjoyed this episode. Be sure to follow us on your favorite podcast streaming service so that you can be alerted when new episodes are released. Follow Michigan Humanities on Facebook and Instagram for exciting news on what's going on in our state. See you next time.